Blog Talk Radio.
This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Tonight's show is Whistleblowers. Our special guests are Tom Mueller, and then we've got William and Carrie coming on a little later in the show. Co-hosting with me is Arlene Mullen with Dialysis Advocates, and we'll be getting to her and everybody else in just a minute. I want to make sure everybody knows these shows are brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit taking place the end of July every year in Washington, D.C. We'll be back again this next year. See you all there, a little older, a little grayer, a little meaner, but that's the way things go. Anyway, onward and upward. And I want to say hello here. I'm getting a big heads up. We've got Australia on with us, Germany, New Zealand, and Canada. So we're picking up people from all over the place. But our guest tonight, our first guest, is Tom Mueller, and he's written a book called Crisis of Conscience, Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud, and it's available on Amazon, also at Barnes & Noble. It's available in Kindle and also in large print for us old folks that have trouble seeing that small stuff. Mr. Mueller, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Marty.
You're welcome. Arlene, did you want to jump in here and say hello?
Of course. And let's talk about our older guest tonight. I mean, radio person, Marty. And and I'm not quite there yet, or at least not admitting it. And I wish to thank Marcel Reed and Marty Oakley for the opportunity to bring out the issues on dialysis that have been silent for far too long. Marty, do you want to interview Tom first?
Sure. Tom, I'm really interested in your book, this Crisis of Conscience, Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud. First off, I want to know what piqued your interest in this. Were you a whistleblower, or did you just come to find a story about this and realize what a scourge it was? Or, you know, what brought you to it?
It, you know, like many great projects, it was pure dumb luck. I bumped into a very distinguished whistleblower lawyer, John Phillips, who had reenacted one of the key whistleblower laws in America, the False Claims Act. And he started telling me about his job and this new law, which is really an old law. It goes back to the Civil War, and the roots go back to medieval England. And I'm a historian by trade, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting little story for an article of some kind. And I started interviewing some of his clients, the whistleblowers who he represented. And time and time again, I heard the same scenarios of these individuals who were doing the right thing. They were trying to defend their organizations. Little did they know that their organizations were not interested in defending them.
Right.
And they called out fraud and were, you know, systematically and viciously retaliated against and fired. And then they brought suit. So it was a group of people, whistleblowers, that gradually grew and grew and grew until I realized that this is an entire community of
yes.
truth tellers who are vital to our democracy.
I have to agree with that. When I first became involved, someone had recommended me to Marcel Reed, and that's probably a day she curses in infamy, but she had gotten a hold of me and asked me if I'd be interested in interviewing some of these people, and I said, sure, you know, and I just figured there might be a handful of people that had some. I had no idea how pervasive mm-hmm. this was what was done to these people, the money, the taxpayer money wasted, not only in the crimes they've committed, but then we have to pay for these criminals' legal fees. And then the people who reported the wrongdoing, which they're required by law to do, if they know about it and see it, they're required to report it. If they don't, and it's discovered at a later time and it's determined they should have known or could have known, they consider them equally as guilty. And yes, and that really stunned me that here they're doing the right thing. And the whole agency will turn on these people and do everything they can to destroy these people's lives. Everything. All of these agencies inside these agencies, like Office of Civil Rights and the Whistleblowers Protection Office and the OIG and all this, are just obstacles put up just to prevent them from doing the right thing. I'm glad you wanted to ask you about that, if you perceive that the same way.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the stunning things to me is that these people really do, the whistleblowers, kind of old-fashioned people, rules people, people who believe in black and white, there's no gray, shades of gray. You know, they empathize with the ultimate victims of what they're doing, or they simply believe that fraud is a bad thing. So there's kind of an old-fashioned way of looking at things, which is a sad comment on our society. But they genuinely have the best interests of their organizations at heart when they start their process. And, you know, it's with great shock late in the game that they realize, wait a second, this fraud and this wrongdoing isn't a bug. It's a feature in this organization. It's
right.
Also true that time and time again, you know, people – if people don't recognize, the people in the abstract think whistleblowers are a great thing, but they don't recognize that there might be whistleblowers in their own organization. So they say, yeah, it's great to have whistleblower laws out there and out there and out there. But in our organization, they're just jerks. You know, they're just narcissists. They're just disgruntled employees. People have this tunnel vision where they don't recognize the fact that every organization has dissenters, and those people need to be cherished and not trampled on.
I agree. One of the things that has just irked me to death here in recent weeks is Trump constantly referring to whistleblowers as leakers. They're leakers. Mm-hmm. No, these are not leakers. They did not leak national security. In fact, I wrote an open letter to him, put on the net, that these are people who are exposing fraud and waste, abuse, discrimination, sexual molestation, rapes, that are occurring in these federal agencies of all places. And what happens is they target that whistleblower and do everything they can to destroy that person and then promote the person that committed the crime.
Can I interject here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. As whistleblower myself, they do destroy you. And I think it takes a lot to, and I think the worst thing they ever could have said to me was, gee, Arlene, nobody else sees the problem. So you start doubting yourself.
Yourself,
and
exactly.
And that is
they
where
isolate.
The wish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
No, that's exactly right. And when you can't deal with the fact, when you can't deal with the message, then try to crush the messenger. Try to discredit the messenger and shift the focus from, you know, the facts that these people or this you or any real whistleblower has brought forward, shift the focus to their motivations, their personality, what they had for breakfast, you know, their sexual orientation, all this stuff that really has nothing to do with the facts at issue. You know, for me, it's interesting to see the Ukraine whistleblower. There are two different ways to spin this. Donald Trump and his allies call them, you know, spies, leakers, treasonous people and so on. But Then there is another group that's enemies of Trump, at least nominally, you know, the observers of the deep state. And they say, oh, no, these whistleblowers, you know what they are? They're really puppets of the spy masters. They're executing the plan. It's like a palace coup. They're executing the plan of the CIA. And so both of those narratives are wrong because they're taking the focus away from the facts that the whistleblower has brought forward and trying to focus attention on the personality and the motives of the whistleblower. And that's whistleblower retaliation 101.
Exactly. In some of these cases that I've dealt with, particularly with women of the Forest Service, many of whom have been raped and sexually molested, been beaten up on the job, left out in the middle of fires, just because women shouldn't be in the, well, I don't know why not. You were screaming bloody murder because women were, you were doing harder work and they couldn't do your work. And now that they're doing your work, you're mad about that. You know what I'm saying? You understand what I'm saying? No, they can't win no matter which way they go. And then to find out, I think one of the worst moments in this in the last year was when Tony Took was allowed to resign behind 26 charges of sexual misconduct and abuse. And he said he just did not have time to respond to all these untrue accusations. Well, I know you didn't because you were busy resigning so you could keep your federal benefits. And and that's what they let them do. But as I've worked through these shows with these people, they're quite emotional. It is always amazing to me the lengths these agencies will go to. And again, this is taxpayer money being blown to target, marginalize, diminish, smear. They plant fake reports in their files. They issue things on the net, articles, fake articles on the net. And one more person posts fake news. I swear my head's going to blow off. But it's just, I'm so sick of the jingoism. But they do this to these people. And then even after they let them go, what I found is they will continue to absolutely harass these people to the ends of the earth, make sure they never get gainful employment again. Their families are destroyed. Their finances are destroyed. What is it you're doing? And what is it you're getting from what you're doing that is so important to you that you have to destroy another person in this way?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand that.
It's something I saw again and again in so many different areas, both public and private, in writing my book, Crisis of Conscience, is it becomes deeply personal. It's no longer about the job. It's no longer about what you did and did not write. It becomes a feeling of treason, of betrayal, and people take it extremely personally. They attack the person who has challenged their authority, and the group, takes sides and tries to demonstrate their loyalty to the authority by attacking this person. It becomes almost a tribal scene. And I think that coming back to the fake reports and files, that's something that I think our next guest will be able to speak to quite a lot, William and Carrie. That notion that in order to destroy someone's credibility, you go back and retroactively add into their files information that fundamentally is incorrect, that makes them look like they've been a trouble all along. It's it's an alarming thing. And it's just taken as that's what we do when someone crosses the line.
Yeah, I just – like I say, this has been an education for me, because to think that in a federal agency of all places where things should be most efficient and following the rules to set the example, it's the worst. It is absolutely the worst. And the cost to us out here in the public isn't just monetary. The cost, although that is substantial, when I look at the VA – and they got this billions and billions of dollars, and this agency is foundering in dysfunction and mismanagement and fraud and waste and abuse and lack of care for patients, and they keep throwing more money at it. But what they're talking about, Tom, is privatization, and this is what they're actually after. That, in my opinion, and you, I want your opinion on this. I think what they're doing is allowing all of these agencies to devolve to such a point that privatization looks like the only option. That way we can have a corporation come in, take it over. Now you won't be able to get any information because they'll claim trade secrets and proprietary rights. And with all of the agencies now destroying any files that are 7 years old or older, your chances for discovery on anything are being narrowed significantly. But this is what I think the focus is. Why else would you let something run and one agency after another run at this level of cost and dysfunction and mismanagement? Why would you do that?
I would like to ask Tom, too, is the fact that with the government is part of the problem. As a whistleblower, the government turns on you, and you pay a price with them.
Yes.
Definitely.
And the patients are playing the ultimate, and you're just somebody that's out there that is just creating problems. And I think as a whistleblower, you understand that for the first time in your life, it is that to kill the messenger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That the messenger is, and you're thinking, gosh, you know, you bring all these documents to the federal government, you got the OIG, GAO, supporting these patients in dialysis and what we're saying, and they do nothing. They are part of the problem, as you well know, Tom.
Absolutely.
Our government
turns
against,
Well, the problem is here that many government agencies have simply been sucked dry by the private sector. I mean, they're thinly veiled facades for corporate America. I mean, you look at dialysis. Two blockbuster companies control 90% of patients in America. It's a travesty. Look at defense. I mean, the Lockheed Martins and the Northrop Grummans of this world are far more powerful than the average government agency, and they run the Pentagon in a real sense. The people in the Pentagon who are their interface is just like the people in the dialysis networks that are the interfaces of these two companies. They are basically looking for the time to catch the revolving door into their next employment, which is going to be much better paid than their current employment in government. And that whole revolving door regulatory capture thing, you can just go down the list of government agencies and see it's true everywhere. I mean, there are monopolies and duopolies and cartels in big pharma, in healthcare, in energy. I mean, you find it again and again. And the power, now that we've accepted, you know, thanks to the Supreme Court, that, you know, money is speech and corporations are people, there's very little place to hide. But the government itself, government regulators are quite often very much on the side of the organizations, of the corporations that are doing the wrongdoing. They're not helping the patients in dialysis or the taxpayers who are being bled white by government, by defense contractor fraud.
Wow. I just, you know, and there again, I just don't understand this, and the only conclusion I can come to is that there is an ulterior motive here. I think what keeps just spinning in my head is the fact that these are federal agencies. And I think, you know, I've sworn all along that all these agencies are actually already privately owned corporations listed on Dun & Bradstreet, and they are contracted to the federal corporation as a governmental services corporation and doing business that way. And the closest I heard anybody come to admitting that was when they were after the FDA last year, and one of the representatives, when he was confronted of, why don't you tell them what to do, said, well, we can advise them and suggest things, but we can't tell them what to do. That's a private business.
No enforcement. No ability to enforce. It looks good in writing, Marty, but they don't enforce it.
Well, if we need to look for an example of how we have given away control over tax dollars to corporations, we need to look no further than the fact that Medicare and Medicaid can't negotiate their own prices for pharmaceuticals with Big Pharma. I mean, that is a travesty of our own dollars being simply given away. If you go anywhere else in the developed world or the undeveloped world, you'll find prices are much lower. I wonder why that is. It's pretty simple, because we are no longer allowed. Our government has been outsourced to the point where we're no longer allowed even to negotiate a proper price for pharmaceuticals. So, big surprise. The gouging is the order of the day here in America.
Yeah, it just, well, and you remember during Bush-Cheney when they raided Medicare and they did the pharmaceutical reform that was going to save, you know, $1.5 billion in money by their, if you just pass this thing, they passed it, it cost $750 billion. And everybody went, oops. And,
Oh, well.
Yeah. Too bad for
but
you.
But it's not our money anymore. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
One of my great whistleblowers in my book, Historic Whistleblowers, Ernie Fitzgerald, back in the 1960s, back when there weren't too many whistleblower laws, he took on, he was working as a civilian in the Pentagon, he took on Lockheed. And, you know, he pointed out that, that the tax money, as soon as it leaves the taxpayers' hands, many government officials think of it as their money. It's no longer taxpayer dollars. It's our dollars. It's our budget.
Yes.
It's what we get, you know, we get to use this. And that's a fundamental violation of their oath of office to husband the public wealth. But
yes,
it seems to be a standard procedure.
Well, it just, you know, when I watched last year with the women from forestry, when they met with Elijah Cummin and others, and I really thought something was going to come out of that. And they nailed Denise Lago and that, what was that guy's name? That second from the top guy that was there. And they lied and lied and lied. And finally, Chavez came out and said, I don't believe a word you're saying. And I thought, bingo, now we're going to do something. Now we're going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
instead, nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened. And they were supposed to be oversight, which it indicated to me that there is no oversight. So, you know, they are powerless.
Well,
go ahead.
Arlene knows a little bit about lots of show and song and dance on the Hill, and then nothing happens, right, Arlene?
Oh, it's a horse and pony show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hearings on the Hill.
You
about
have hearings.
In 2000, was it?
Yeah, it was in 2000 with Senator Grassley, who knew, who, when we had that hearing, we had the OIG, we had the GAO support that our patients were at risk. That's 2000. And it was such a critical point. It was 6 months when the Office of the Inspector General took over from the GAO and demanded a hearing. That hearing was a horse and pony show, and one of our witnesses was threatened before he went to D.C. He was brave enough to bring it up in that hearing, and Grassley saying, oh, my God, if they do anything, you're a federal witness, blah, 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 you just let me know. Well, we let him know that they killed him less than 3 months later. Nothing has ever been done. And even in the Senate hearing, Tom, I saw what was coming down, and the devil has arrived.
Yeah. Say, you two, we have a caller on. Caller, area code 703. You're live and on the air.
Hi, guys. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Marcel.
Hi.
Hi, Marcel.
It's Marcel. Hey, how are you?
No, this is like old home week.
Yes. Everyone, this is our guest is Marcel Reed from the Whistleblower Summit. Go ahead, Marcel.
Well, first of all, I read Tom's book, and I wanted to say a couple of things in addition to how modestly he is describing his work. As you all know, especially you, Marty, and you, Arlene, whistleblowing is complicated, and it's complicated because it's so extremely simple. Whistleblowing is just the process of telling the truth. That's all. It's no more, it's no less. And the problem happens to every whistleblower I've ever encountered because they believed that telling the truth was enough. And therein lies the crux of the problem with whistleblowers. They've done a number of studies about what makes whistleblowers different and why do they do what 90, if there are 100 people, only two will blow the whistle, the other 98 won't say a word. And I think it isn't an issue of some kind of flaw within whistleblowers. I think with whistleblowers, they believe that the truth will shield them. When I became a whistleblower, I wasn't working for a large corporation. I was working for a large corporation, but that's not who I blew the whistle on. I blew the whistle on an organization that was the largest grassroots organization in the country with phenomenal power. And I had risen to the top of that organization, and I joined that organization because I wanted to fight poverty. And I did everything in my power to keep that organization afloat without it exploiting its members. So I didn't go outside of the organization to report. I went inside of the organization to try to save it. And what happened was the ripping of my integrity started to occur, which I'm sure happens with every whistleblower I've ever spoken to. All of a sudden, I became marginalized. The very idea that 2 weeks earlier were considered innovative were now considered counterproductive and destructive. People that I had known for years became enemies almost overnight, and those that were not enemies were ostracized. And there is this strange freezing out of whistleblowers within their own environments. And people talk about money curing what happens to a whistleblower, but it doesn't cure it. In my case, there was never any money awarded, nor was there ever going to be any money awarded. But I found that a new attack on whistleblowers has been that they show programs showing whistleblowers receiving huge amounts of reward under the QITAM, False Claims Act. And now every time I say the word whistleblowers to civilians, you know what they repeat to me now, Tom? How much did you get?
Going, the winning lottery.
That's right. How much did you get? I know you got something because I see this on television. And all I see on television is you blow the whistle and you get a huge amount of money. And with that, you get fame and a movie.
Right.
Well,
so
the thing is, what they don't tell is that that amount of money may be awarded, but that whistleblower rarely sees a dime of it. It is a rare occasion that they ever see the money that was awarded. If it's ever even paid, the attorneys very quickly snap it up, and the IRS comes in and takes the rest of it, and if they get $10, they're lucky, but they don't tell that part of it. This, they got awarded $40 million, you know, and they're just living a lavish lifestyle in a tent down by the river, and they're begging for food because they got so much in a, you know, I mean, it's just so terrible. CBS is the one that's doing that whistleblower series where they are painting these people like the only reason they blew the whistle. I mean, they're clever in the way they do it. But the message is very clear. The only reason they told was to make money. Otherwise, they didn't care.
And, and that completely
clashes
with
Marty,
my experience.
Well, they also, Marty, you lose, like with me, I lost 20 years of employment, which is 20 years of my Social Security. It is not a healthy way to live.
Right.
No.
Right.
No, you make a lot more money by hunkering down and getting with the program and executing the fraud than you ever do. The occasional whistleblower makes a lot of money, and I've met two of them. One couldn't stop crying because she was talking about in her lavish house. She couldn't stop crying every time I interviewed her because she was thinking about all of the sealed documents and all of the harm that she could no longer talk about. And Alan Jones, who I talk about at the beginning of my book, he feels that he can't really trust anybody in the world anymore because the world turned on him so viciously, so strongly, that he has a hard time with trust. And these are the lucky ones. These are the ones who weren't just actually crushed personally and professionally by what they experience. These are the ones who got through and are supposedly the success stories. So I think, Marcel, you're absolutely right. This is a smokescreen to make people think this is all about money. And committing the truth is actually, as Ernie Fitzgerald once said, committing the truth is actually what this is about. So many whistleblowers I interviewed, they never even knew there was any money in this until after they were fired, after the whole thing started. This is about doing the right thing in the vast majority of cases. And in fact, if you take on a multinational corporation or a major government agency and your facts aren't in order, well, they just make you go away. You don't last 15 seconds. If your facts are in order, then they start to attack the messenger because they can't deal with the message.
Right. Exactly. Yeah,
to me, Tom, was that they took $10,000, the state of Oregon. I happened to go to an Oregon senator, and they took $10,000 out of my account for taxes that I didn't pay to stop me. However, I worked in Washington State, which is a non-tax state, and my home base was in Washington. But they returned it 6 years later, $6,000. And that was one of the senators that was on the Senate committee coming in really angry, upset over the people in Oregon. Let me tell you, he fired us and told us not to bother him anymore, his office.
Yeah, it's a lot of trouble to work things out with big corporations, and they're totally vulnerable patients. It's hard work.
Marcel,
that's what the senator should be doing.
I just wanted to read a single sentence from Tom's book, Crisis of Conscience. And what I like about the way he has written it and the way that he has chronicled the stories from these different people is that at the end of each chapter, he summarizes it in a way that you understand without leaving the next chapter hanging independently. But there is one phrase that I have from his chapter, Blood and Ivory Towers, and I just like to read it very quickly because to me it summarizes what the new campaign is against whistleblowers. And I want to preface that by saying that earlier this week I was at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because they have an ethical standards guideline they've been working on. And I thought it would be a good opportunity to marry that with the baseline ethics of whistleblowing. But this is what Tom said. He said, Homo economicus is a living cost-benefit analysis whose behavior is sharply divorced from any hazy questions of right and wrong. So when you take everything in the human experience and settle it into a spreadsheet of profit and loss, there is no room for right nor wrong. And that is the peculiar problem when you speak to people who are rooted with the entire belief that you can reduce everything to profit and loss and profit being viewed as monetary, as opposed to viewing it as a case of ethics. And because we have no framework for ethics, and the only touchstone we have is money, whistleblowers are going to always have an uphill battle because you cannot quantify good, but you can quantify cash.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's an easy game to finance and business in general is an easy game to score because it's scored in dollars. You can keep score and you see who's winning and who's losing. But in that process, people lose sight of the actual right and wrong, the ethics of what they're doing. In fact, they've been told that corporations, you know, Milton Friedman and that whole movement has proselytized the notion that corporations shouldn't think about ethics and morality and all that messy stuff. They should just think about profits and let everyone else worry about, you know, that hand-wringing, sissy stuff, the soft stuff, the weak stuff that is our morality and our ethics. Well, guess what? That's how we get to this situation where literally people can gray out the entire question of whether someone's being harmed, says whether someone's being killed, so whether this is actually good or bad for society, and just focus on, you know, their quarterly earnings. This is a big problem. This is a big myopia, and I think, Marcel, you put your finger right on it, that's a fundamental philosophical reframing that we've undergone, that somehow we've been sold this bill of goods that, you know, our forebears would not have bought, but we seem to be sort of stuck in this mind frame.
This whole thing, the monetary, if you're talking profit and loss, how much money are we as a country losing on a daily basis allowing this to go on, paying all the legal fees for these people, any fines and penalties for these people, while they walk away scot-free? Even if they get taken to court, they lose nothing. Before that ever happens, like I say, they're allowed to retire, actually told to retire, so they can retain all their benefits. So we keep on paying them, even after they have done this. Yes.
It used to be where when you were working, you did a good job and you were rewarded for the good job. It seems like not anymore. It's whoever can keep the best secret and be part of the game. Dialysis, yeah. And I want to bring on Carrie. Dialysis, the sad part is, it's not about health care. It's about profit. And if I could just bring it on, and Tom, if you could kind of interjoin in this, and Marty too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Carrie?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yes,
hello. How are you doing, Marty?
Hi.
We just want to hear your story. I mean, yours was unbelievable of what happened. I advocated for you, and I think that I would not have been or had enough courage as you did to have to put up with the abuse and intimidation that you did. So out of your words, it's much better than out of mine.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing us to be on your show today.
Sure.
Started out on dialysis. They put me on there September 1st, 2015. Was my first treatment for dialysis, and then I went to a clinic like a week later. And about 2 weeks into it, my heart catheter stopped up, and they seriously just told me to get up and leave. They didn't call an ambulance. They didn't tell me to go to an access center. They didn't call my doctor. I asked them to call my doctor to tell me what to do. I mean, I was just on dialysis, and that was the first 2 weeks in. And they told me just to leave the building. Don't come back until I got it fixed.
But the access was non-visible.
Yeah.
Or accessible. Huh. So we had to find our vascular surgeon that put the access in and ask him what we needed to do. Who do we need to call? And he said, well, the dialysis clinic, they're supposed to send you to their vascular surgeon, their access center, and have it fixed. So we asked around, and they never told us anything. Our doctor that we were supposed to see was out of country and wasn't supposed to be back for another 2 weeks. And this is just protocol. This thing happens. And mind you, this is like our third week into dialysis.
I went 8 days without dialysis until we finally got a doctor.
We had to drive about an hour and a half to a vascular center that was affiliated with the Fresenius Clinic and told us that, you know, come on up here. We have an opening. We'll get you fixed up and find out what's wrong with it. So, of course, you know, got to have that taken care of. Got to have dialysis.
Whenever got the surgery, went back, did okay for a little while.
Went on for about a year and a half, and everything was real smooth. I mean, we had a 4 o'clock in the morning chair time every other day. 5 a.m. chair time. Had to be there early. Everything was, we were getting accustomed to everything. This was our new life. We are now, you know, hooked up to a machine for however long it takes for us to take care of this. So me and my wife, Carrie, we're getting adjusted to this. And for a year and a half goes by, every morning, same routine.
Well, and then, you know, they got me an appointment to go, you know, look for a transplant. And as I'm looking at my labs and stuff, my phosphorus is going up, and they gave me some medication samples that were going to try to get it approved for me through Medicare or whatever. And I filled out some paperwork and was on top of it for a couple of months asking, hey, have you heard anything back? You know, I need a prescription for this. I need another sample. And about 3 months later, I finally got the nurse, the nutritionist who was taking care of it, told her, you know, hey, they told me y'all are down to your last bottle sample of this Bosrenol binder I had to take for phosphorus. And she said, well, let me check on it. She came back and said that the place they had lost my application. I was going to have to put in a new application and so forth. Well, I got a letter from the place, pharmaceutical company, because they're trying to get the medication for me on a charitable contribution.
Yeah, had to donate the
it was like
3 10, months of medication.
It's, yeah, it was like $10,000 a month medication. And so I got a letter telling me I was accepted and it would be there anytime. And I looked at the day of the letter and said, thank you for your application on this date. And I started looking at it. Well, when I got to dialysis, I asked them for a copy of the application that they submitted for me.
The pharmacy company never told us where they were going to mail it to. They just said they were going to mail it to the address on the application.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I don't really.
Well, I didn't fill out the application, so I wanted to see the application to find out where they're going to mail it, because we have a commercial apartment and also a house.
And we didn't want it to go to the clinic or to the house, or, you know, that's $30,000 worth of medication sitting on the porch.
From a manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make sure it was okay and where it was going. So we asked for the application.
Well, I got to reading the application, and I got down to the signature line, and I noticed they cut and pasted my signature identically in two spots on the same page of this application. And my background.
Red flags went up immediately.
As my background, tell a little bit about my background. I'm a 30-year corporate controller, retired, financial corporate controller. Specialize in fraud and misappropriation. Most of my career as a consultant controller, also at compliance issues, making sure things were in compliance with, you know, federal law and standards, principles, and, you know, stuff like that.
They messed with
so
the wrong person,
knew,
I'd say.
Well, I immediately knew they're out of compliance. Why would they do this if they could? I know Medicare will work with you. Did they try Medicare first? Well, I started questioning things like, why are we going outside to this pharmacy? Did you try to get it, you know, approved through Medicare and
Medicaid?
Yeah, I didn't have Medicaid. I only had Medicare.
All taken care of. Have you guys gone through? What's going on here?
Well, when I found out, saw the fraud, I immediately got upset because I couldn't believe they did that. So I looked up their grievance policy, what to do. You know, what do you do when you find something wrong? Because I wanted to make sure that I followed what their rules were. So I requested a meeting. You know, I took the paperwork in there. I showed them the fraud right in front of them, the two signatures.
The application
identical.
They gave us.
It was copies, of course. I asked them. I said I wanted them to do an investigation on it. I wanted them to pull the original documents and compare them themselves, and I wanted them to resolve the issue by filing an ethics complaint against the nurse who did it and legally charge them for fraud. And that's what I asked them to do. Immediately left, got home, started looking things up on the internet, found Arlene.
Looking all over the place trying to find help for dialysis, and there's none.
And I was looking for an attorney or an advocate, and I found Arlene at Dialysis Advocates. Will called her up, told her what was going on. She told us what to expect, and it all happened.
She says, careful. I've heard this story over and over.
Every bit of it happened. The next day I went in to dialysis. We were met with a security guard, armed security guards. They refused to let my husband take my stuff in there and get me set up in my chair. They kept him out of there.
They let everybody in the clinic go in first.
And we did that for a few days, and I got upset. with them. People refused to pull my needles out of my arm because I have a problem with bleeding. They didn't want to pull my needles out of my arm because, you know, they were scared to get in trouble because I might say something. I don't know.
Or they're doing it the wrong way.
Yeah. They let me bleed for like 12 minutes one time, you know, and these are arteries. Scared me. Sent me out in the middle of the room in front of everybody so they could put another chair in to get somebody else in there because I was bleeding too long. They started being really passive aggressive, started taking notes on me and putting them in my medical records. I knew this because I was going to the transplant place, so I've got copies of all my records that from a nurse that was there, and of course upper management didn't know I had copies of all my records up to a certain date. And when all that happened, I asked for copies of my records from them, started comparing what they had before. They went back and started changing and adding things and notes and lying.
The notes were putting in as a patient complaint form.
Yeah,
The risk of violence.
That I was being violent.
She had infiltrated her arms multiple times
on purpose.
Refused dialysis service. And then as Arlene was telling us the stages that they were going through, that she goes, you guys are going to be in for a one hell of a ride. And she wasn't kidding. It started out with just us asking, and then they put her in a patient agreement form as being a combative patient and told her she had 30 days to change her attitude and change her minds and about, you know, this is the way things are. And as soon as the 30 days were over, they ended up giving us a 30-day get-out letter. And we had Arlene on the speaker.
A termination letter. And as soon as they showed me that it was terminated, I told Arlene was on the phone with us, of course. And they brought in the vice president of Fresenius, the medical director, and their attorney, and their local general manager to kick me out. Now, that's overkill for a billion-dollar corporation
and
to come in and kick out a, you know, combat patient.
We've only been a patient at this clinic for a year and a half, only been on dialysis for a year and a half, and we've only wanted to find out if her kidneys would still function without it because she was born with bad kidneys. She was born with renal insufficiency, wasn't supposed to live past age 12, wasn't ever supposed to have kids, and we have a 20-year-old son.
Yeah, my kidneys are the size of 7-year-olds. They've always been, you know, sick. And
I've been with my wife for over 20 years, and when my son was born, I had a big decision to choose between my wife and my son because having my son would have meant killing my wife. And I've had her forever. I love her. And to have something like this go through and thinking you're in the medical field for help on a life-saving procedure for the rest of her life.
But what about the paramedics?
Yeah, that's what I was fixing to tell you about. After they made me sign a care agreement, they told my husband that he could not go in there, that he could sit out in the waiting room. I went in there. I asked him, I said, can I skip today? Because I'm really upset over this care agreement stuff. They told me no. My heart was racing. I went in there and got really scared because, you know, they had armed security guard outside. They had an armed security guard in there with me by my chair. And when I got in there, you know, my heart rate was going up. So they were, you know, trying to put the cuff on me, the machines going off, the bells and stuff, because my blood pressure was like 240 over 130. I mean, it was really bad, really high.
Having a big panic attack.
I was having a panic attack, and I was trying to explain to them. And of course,
we're trying to find out why there's an armed security guard. Why are they giving us this agreement?
Yeah.
We're trying to, you know, just trying to take care of my wife so she can get a kidney.
As I was sitting there, and I was crying, and I was trying to calm down so, you know, they could dialyze me and stuff, my blood pressure kept just going up and up and up. And they weren't letting my husband in there at all. I was on the phone with my cousin and him, you know, trying to calm down so they could dialyze me because my blood pressure was too high.
I'm outside on the phone with Arlene at 5 o'clock in the morning.
And they took me off the cuff on the machine that was recording my blood pressure and started doing it by hand. And that scared me to death. I felt that
they
were going to let me die. I thought they were I was going to have a stroke, a heart attack, and they were just standing there staring at me.
Well, I really thought you were going to go out. I really did.
And
I got
it
on
sounds
the phone
like they
and
were
I
hoping you would. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I called 911 and had the ambulance. I told them a quick story of what was going on and said, hey, I need your help. They showed up quick. I mean, they were right there. They go in, they ask me what's going on, and I stepped up and I told them real quick, you know, and the police came by and the clinic manager come out and asked them both, why are you guys here? Knowing full well my wife is in the back with having heart rates that are just, you know, stroke level. And I looked at her and I said, I called them. And the paramedics went back and did a welfare check on her and put her on the gurney and brought her outside and asked where she wanted to go. And she said, just take me to Baylor, take me to Baylor. They put her in the ambulance.
Yeah.
I'm talking with the officers. I'm talking with the clinic manager, the nurse. We're trying to figure things out.
Panicking.
She's still having a blood pressure and a heart rate.
Called,
crazy.
I thought they were taking me to Terrell. I didn't know who called the ambulance. I didn't know if it was the clinic trying to get rid of me. I didn't know until my husband stuck his head in and said, I called the police.
The paramedic came over and got me and said, sir, can you please come talk to your wife? She needs to talk to you. So I calmly walked over to the back of the ambulance, stepped up in the back of the ambulance, put my hand on her, and said, honey, I'm the one that called the police.
You're okay.
You're okay. I'll meet you at Baylor.
But they wouldn't
I
release her.
Of, yeah, I stepped out of the ambulance.
My blood pressure immediately went down. The paramedic
was like, before I got out. And he was like, what did you do to her? I just told her it would be okay.
I was scared. I didn't know who was taking – they were taking me away. You know, I didn't know what they were doing. They were trying to keep my husband away from me. And they were making up stories in their medical records. We found out. They were saying that he was a racist, all kinds of stuff.
The more we started looking into the clinic and all the horror stories that was going on, it was more terrifying. And I've never felt so helpless with somebody that was supposed to be giving care. It was very mortifying hearing my wife scream and cry on the inside of this building that I couldn't go see. I couldn't go touch her. I couldn't say, it's okay. Just calm down, honey. We'll go through this.
Weren't you threatened, too, by the security guard, if I remember right?
Yes,
he
was standing in front of me the whole time while they're telling me to calm down so I could get dialyzed, and I was making it worse, and I was doing it to myself. And he was
because
standing in front
I know
of me
that
with,
I...
With a gun, yeah.
He was at full dress sitting inside the treatment room.
And I got on to
him. Because they wouldn't
Yeah, because I retired from a security company.
Yeah,
that
was normal for you.
I knew a lot about security guards and what he could and could not do, and he was violating the law by standing over me with a gun. Being a security guard, a commission security guard, and
are
I
you on
them,
dialysis now, Carrie?
No, actually, when they kicked me out, they blackballed me at all the dialysis clinics within like a 50-mile radius. They
every
take
bit
me.
Of a 50-mile radius.
Yeah,
I called probably 7 different dialysis clinics, and they all were refused because she was a legal liability as a patient.
They didn't want to take me on, and I kept going up to Baylor. Every day to get dialysis, so they told me I had to do an emergency. They said, Carrie, your blood's not dirty enough. Well, then I finally got a hold. Yeah.
3 months we drove from our house to Baylor, which is 45 miles one way. Sat in the ER room of Dallas, for 8 hours to find out that her blood wasn't bad enough to be dialyzed.
Finally got a hold of my vascular surgeon, made an appointment with him, and went in, took my paperwork, the fraud and everything, and sat him down and showed him the fraud and told him what happened to me. And he says, I don't know what to do, Carrie.
We're worried about her access, worried about her fistula, about this dialysis.
Let me go in. I'll do an angioplasty on your fistula, so make sure it's cleaned out, and I'll get a consult from another nephrologist. And we did. And come to find out, I didn't need dialysis, and I have not been on dialysis since they kicked me out. And that's been February 2017.
2 weeks after they kicked her out, I tried to get prescriptions filled, and the pharmacy wouldn't fill them because her nephrologist was no longer her doctor.
Yeah. the clinic, and so they would
right.
heal her.
Which means you can get no medications or anything like that anymore, because and people don't realize that you have to be near death.
Well,
and therefore you don't have a physician that can order if you're terminated from care, and you can only be treated when you're near your potassium is near death.
Yeah.
And these companies make more money with this happening because they're getting emergency care money. They made money by terminating you.
Can I ask what happened to the $30,000 in medications that were ordered by someone else in your name? What happened to those medications?
Well, I got the medications in, okay?
They got delivered to the clinic.
They got delivered to the clinic. I was able to get them because I was there on a care agreement. But come to find out, when I went to the new nephrologist, he called Medicare. They approved it with no big deal. So I did a little research on it, and I actually think that the pharmaceutical company that actually was giving it to me for charity or were in cahoots with Fresenius somehow. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
For real. Needs to be
well, they own their own pharmacies.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. They're definitely, yeah, I don't know why that Fresenius didn't just go to Medicare and get my medication. Why they had to go outside of the you know, the
did this
process.
Involve the American Kidney Association? Was that part of the charity picture?
No, it was
Shire Care
Pharmaceutical Company.
Shire Care. Okay. That's an interesting point, because there's definitely a game being played there, and someone's making numbers. They're definitely getting a cut. Yeah.
I cross-referenced their, you know, being an ex-financial person and fraud person.
Mm-hmm.
I cross-referenced their shareholders, and they have similar shareholders. So it could be a subsidiary of them or, you know, something like that.
Yeah. But your story is the perfect storm for where healthcare, as William and Kara, you both have said, you're supposed to be getting healthcare here. Your health is being cared for, and on the other hand, you are being systematically squeezed for money and abused, and then terminated when you raise your voice. This is the perfect storm
Well, that and also when I was on Medicaid for like 4 months before my Social Security kicked in, they were self-billing me. They're billing me, you know, as a payer myself, and they were billing me $128,000 a month through self-pay. Yeah.
Wow.
And then when we got on Medicare, they're only billing Medicare $5,500 a month, but they're billing Medicaid $150,000 a month.
So they're really
making their money off the Medicaid patients and the private care patients, and the people on Medicare, well, they, of course, have contracts with them. So the people on Medicare is not getting the care that other people are getting. I don't get a ride back and forth to dialysis. I have to have friends take me and family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't get that kind of care because I don't have the, you know, where they're making money off of.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
yeah,
is Medicaid and private insurance.
Oh, and it's a money machine. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
There was 12 chairs in that clinic, and they had 4 sets of patients for each chair.
And let me ask you this: how many people had the knowledge, the smarts, and the experience to be able to guess what was going on? I mean, you are one in a million, where you could actually see what was happening. Most of your fellow patients there in those chairs were just unwilling victims and had no clue what the game was being played, right? Right.
The empty chair speaks volumes to every other patient in that room not to complain.
Yep.
Oh.
All day long.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you right now, I sat in that clinic when this started happening, and I sat for 4 hours every other day with my wife sitting in the back room. And I got to talking and listening to patients that come in different hours while we're waiting. And every story, it all ended of their, why say anything? Nothing gets done.
Well, that, and they were scared they were going to die. It's like if they said anything, they were going to die, you know?
Every patient feels like a burden on their own family, let alone to the clinic.
And they're vulnerable. If they speak up, if they complain, then they all of a sudden are the nail that's waiting for the hammer.
Well, they would do things, you know, to be tortured. I mean, like they would put alcohol on you wet and then put your needles in so it would burn a little. When they pulled it out, they'd cut you a little. I mean, they would just do things passive aggressive to you.
They would dry you. They would dehydrate you.
Yeah, they would take too much fluid off of you. You'd dehydrate. We could barely walk out of there. And they would do those things on purpose. And when I brought it to their attention, like my dry weight is this, don't take out but this, you know, stuff like that, by just knowing what they're supposed to do, they started taking out more fluid and making me sick. And then finally they just,
I've seen patients have their tourniquet left on when they turned the machine on.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was scary.
Yeah.
I seen how quickly when they did a infiltration with my wife and they turned the machine on at full blast and it poured what looked like a 2 cans of Coke into her arm.
Yeah.
And bruised her and said, well, I'm sorry, there's not much we can do about it.
Yeah, they adjusted my needles and turned the machine on 300 as soon as it turned on and just blew my whole arm out.
And mind you, my wife don't weigh but maybe
110
pounds.
Boy.
And her arms aren't very big around to have, you know, 16-gauge needles stuck in them.
Let me ask this. Who made the diagnosis that she needed dialysis when she didn't? Who did that?
That was the
Dallas Nephrology
Clinic at Baylor. It was actually my nephrologist clinic.
He was retiring, and
he said
that if you don't do this now, Carrie, there's no telling what's going to happen.
I see.
And the kidney, it was a long-lasting kidney infection, and throughout the years, they don't know what kidney infection is going to cause her kidneys to quit.
And there's a function every time I have an infection, and I have chronic infection, so it could be the next one, you know? So that's kind of where they were standing at.
The blood work and everything else warranted her to be in the emergency room and get looked at to find out what's going on.
Yeah, and at the time, my growth filtration rate was 11, and the standard is 15. So I was below the GFR rate for them to actually put me on there, but
nobody asked the history.
Yeah, and they didn't. They didn't. When I told them my kidneys are working, I'm still urinating. I told them I knew my kidneys were working. They wouldn't listen to me, telling me I was crazy. The doctor said, "Carrie, your kidneys just don't start working again." I said, "Listen, my kidneys are working. I know they are."
The whole year in the dialysis, we're trying to tell them that she felt function. She felt pain. She knew they were there. They're doing something.
Asked them to test them again. They wouldn't test them. And then the final test is when they kicked me out, and here I am, still working. They're still working.
10 years ago, she only had 18% function in her kidneys.
Yeah, and I still have 9% function in my kidneys, and I'm not on dialysis.
Well,
wow.
What do you think?
Required to do 4 hours.
Well, it's good for cash flow to get as many people, scoop as many people into the dialysis process as possible. If you talk to foreign nephrologists, they will universally tell you that in America, the standards are far lower than in other countries for who the thresholds for who is put on dialysis. And several distinguished nephrologists say that causes serious problems when you start dialysis too early. So this is part of a business model for sure.
So the clinic just opened up a new building not even 50 miles away that has up to 50 to 100 chairs.
Oh my
and word. Does now outpatient dialysis.
They're just getting bigger. I filed a complaint with the state of Texas, and of course CMS, you know, they oversight themselves. In other words, they audit themselves. So
which,
as an auditor, that just, you know, that's internal audit. There's no outside person looking into their practices and the way they do things. And when I filed my complaint with the state of Texas, they found in my favor. But here's what happened was
They didn't send me anything showing they found in my favor. They gave me a courtesy call telling me they found in my favor. And they secretly went and changed everything in the clinic, you know, changed the chairs, the machines, the staff. They called in inspectors for the water.
We had friends that, you know, you create a family in the dialysis field, and people don't meet nobody, and then all of a sudden you're there for a lifetime, and you create a new family. And when we left, we still had phone numbers and contacts with people that were still doing dialysis at the same place, and found out after we were gone, they now have three people with kidneys.
Yeah, I was there a year and a half. Nobody got a kidney. 2 years now I've been off of it. It's been five people who've got kidneys now.
Five people now.
So I don't think they're even giving people kidneys in my clinic. You know, they're just making money. They made over $1 million off just me.
Little small town in the middle of nowhere in the outskirts of a big city.
Who's going to check, right? And if you give someone a kidney, then they come off your cash flow. It doesn't sound like good for
there
the business model to me.
Well, right here, back here a couple months ago, Arlene had a show coming up, and these shows on dialysis have created quite a stir. And this announcement came out that Trump, the morning after her show was to air, was signing an executive order, the first line of which was that he was going to see to it that more kidneys were available for transplant. And I thought, how are you going to do that? At the same time, New York comes out and says they're considering a law that will make everyone an organ donor, whether they want to be or not. And considering the most viable organs come from people of dark skin color, I thought, guess who's going to be on the table getting carved up? So the other thing they said in this executive order was that home dialysis was going to be more readily available because he was creating a program where people could dialyze at home with these machines at home, and they wouldn't have to make these trips, and this was just going to be wonderful. And I thought, wait a minute, this is just too coincidental. So I got to digging around, and I find where Fresenius and a couple other of these companies that do this had been busy in the 6 weeks before buying up all of the companies who manufactured home dialysis machines. And I thought, well, this can't be it. And the president and the whole world's fallen apart, and suddenly he's concerned about kidneys. This was no accident. This was no incidental thing.
Well,
this was a backdoor deal. And
right.
It was to help these companies keep a corner on this market with no oversight and this constant churning out of money, funding fees, fee-based business. Go ahead.
They want to go into transplants now, the industry.
Yes, I'm sure they
do. If they go into transplants, who is going to oversee them? Because once again, they have the Stark Law, which makes them immune. You know, they can profit off their patients. I truly believe, and I haven't called much wrong in this industry, they are wanting to do the same thing as they do in these clinics and make money off of it, more investors, because they're allowed to. We have to kill that Stark Law.
The transplant boards are nothing but death panels for kidney patients.
Yeah, because
yes.
That's one of the things they said, that my husband and my goddaughter was not enough support for me to even get a transplant. That I would need an army to help me out.
She
getting
wasn't
me
a
to
good
support.
Candidate.
I wasn't a good candidate because I didn't have enough support with my husband. Wasn't enough support.
Carrie, they do that. They do that on purpose.
Yeah, it's a mental
and
state
the reason
for the
they. Do that on purpose. It's a nice way of saying you're not going to get one. We also have, I think it's Mayo Clinic, that has to have patients put $5,000 in a savings account, bank account, before they can qualify, because to prove that they can pay for their transplant drugs. You know that's going to be gone. That just stops. And I think Marcel I'm using that zip code. It depends on your zip code.
Yes.
Keep people down. And
I
those people
that.
Pardon?
I said, I agree with that.
Yeah, in other words, keep you poor, keep you down. And it's called, it's nothing more than cherry picking.
When we got introduced to this whole dialysis sitting on the Baylor 14th floor, they came in and handed us a paper saying, if you want a transplant, you're going to need $150,000 in an escrow account. You're going to need a donor. And if you'd like a kidney and a heart transplant, you're going to need $260,000.
And they said, you might as well
now,
try
can
to.
Your zip code afford that?
Not even.
And also, a lot of people don't realize that we've had patients that are ready to go in to get that transplant. They have been gone through everything to have a doctor make a call. If they're mad at you, it happens. We have plenty of cases of it, and said this patient is non-compliant. They don't have to prove anything, but you just lost that kidney.
Well, that's why what I think the clinic did to me, because because the social worker to me came and said, "Well, I just, you know, they just, well, let's give it 6 months, and maybe you can get some more support, and maybe, you know, you can be, you know, get things cleared up where you're more compliant with your diet and things like that." I'm like, wait a second.
You're
my
more
numbers,
accustomed to the dialysis.
And I said, wait a second. My numbers are great. I'm right on my targets on every one
the
of my numbers.
The best patient in the clinic as far as the numbers
Yeah, because they had to be. My kidneys were still working, so I had to be the best numbers in the clinic, you know.
I just got an email here from a lady named Kathleen, and she is in Maryland. And she is saying, she said, listening to the show, and she said, I heard this thing about zip codes. This is some of that conspiracy theory stuff. Take your tinfoil hats off and get real. Okay, Kathleen, I have my tinfoil hat off. And let me tell you a little something, sweetie. I got caught in this zip code thing in the early 70s down in Georgia. And I had had two children by C-section, and I had a tubal ligation. And I got sick and went in the hospital, and they performed a total hysterectomy on me for no apparent reason. And I found out many years later that because of the zip code I lived in and many other women across the five southeastern states in what they considered low middle income neighborhoods, which is where I was. I'm raising two boys by myself. They wanted to make sure I didn't have any more children, sweetie. So they gutted me like a deer. And this was part of that program of sterilization to make sure by zip code and income, you didn't have any more children, even though I couldn't have any anyway. So you take that little thought and stick it in your tinfoil hat and take it on somewhere else. Thank you. Goodbye.
Typical industry talk. That's typical industry talk.
Sure.
This is Carrie. I want to say something about this, too, because I'm an ex-corporate controller in insurance, and I want to tell you, we set every single rate by zip code. We underwrite policies by zip code, and that includes care. So you don't need a tinfoil hat to look that up. It's insurance law. She needs to get educated.
Yep, exactly. And these programs go on under all different auspices all over the country all the time, whether it's sterilization or whatever it is. The people on dialysis, what I have discovered is that if you're not some high-income dialysis patient, you tend to suffer quite a bit and have a lot of difficulty in the clinic.
I had a talk yesterday, Marty, with somebody from where I used to live, Palm Springs area, right? And he says, well, I know somebody that works in, I said, that is a wealthy area. And I said, they're not going to be treated the same because these people who will come from the high zip codes, no lawyers, no doctors, they're not poor that can't put $250,000 in a bank account. There's something wrong with this system. And I guess maybe I do have an aluminum hat, but you know what? I at least can see reality.
Yes, there you go.
I hear it every day from patients, so I feel sorry for you. So much for empathy.
Carrie, can you repeat that again about how they price insurance by zip code? Can you talk again about that? I just got another. Could she repeat that?
Yes. Well, I was ex-insurance controller as well for actually three or four insurance companies. And one of the ways you set rates is by zip code. I mean, even your liability insurance on your vehicles are set by zip codes, distance away from, you know, metropolitan areas, what kind of traffic you have to drive through. So, yeah, all rates are set by zip codes.
Are you going to hit animals?
Yeah, and that's just automobile. Now, in healthcare, those things are also set by zip codes because access to hospitals, you know, that creates liabilities. You can't get to the hospital in 45 minutes, you know. So, yeah, almost rates are set by zip codes. And what's going
wow.
on and the things in the area to help with in case, you know, catastrophic events.
Wow. Who knew? Yeah. Jiminy Christmas.
Interest
I tell you,
controllers,
you
though.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, in doing these shows, I, you know, occasionally have these people who email in and their own biases, prejudices, and everything with these smart-ass remarks that obviously haven't got a clue about anything, as Kathleen seems to
it's
be
not
clueless.
That they don't have a clue. They choose not to have a clue.
Yeah, that's probably more accurate. Yes. Yes, and I think one of the things I have found in all of this stuff that I do is people have these hard-formed opinions and what they think about things, and usually the harder ground in they are, the less educated they are about the topic. And I see the most anger and retaliation and attempts to intimidate from people that you put the information in front of them and say, here it is. Here's what I was telling you about.
Well,
now, call me a conspiracy theorist again, and they absolutely go off the deep end. Just screaming,
well,
you know, the conspiracy theory. You know,
I embrace it because, you know, small minds, you know, they are not
well,
living the hell.
That way. The nurses
they're
that were
not
there.
Living the hell of the treatment that you get. But I'll
right.
tell you one thing. 20 years of doing this, I can honestly say and document it, is that the minorities are the ones, and the zip codes are the ones who get poor treatment. They are the ones who do not get the transplant. There's a million excuses as to why they can't have it. This is real. And I guess
well, because
I feel that. Like I feel bad because that woman, the way our man is going to end up possibly on dialysis. It is a nightmare, and it's like being in reform school with no civil rights or a voice. Am I
well,
right?
If any luck, if
yeah,
she gets needs dialysis, I hope she's living in the ghetto so she can see what it's like. But go ahead.
Well, I don't wish dialysis on anyone.
I when I was laying there on dialysis, when I told them that, you know, they were violating my civil rights, that they were violating my civil rights, and I gave them like three or four different laws they were breaking. They looked at me and said, mm-hmm. I don't care about your civil rights.
It's about you.
But
oh,
you know why?
Wow.
Do you know why they say that?
Yes. That's
they
exactly
say
they
that because
said,
no matter where,
civil rights. Huh?
Wherever you complain goes back to them.
Yes.
Civil rights. We are going after civil rights. And really, Marty, stop and think about it. If we have all these lawyers that, and so we have the NAACP now because they believe that they're are very definitely civil rights violation in this, and you can't even choose where to go. You are owned by your nephrologist group the minute you hit the hospital and get the diagnosis. I can't walk across the street and get a choice. I can't go anywhere and complain. So I guess that maybe the NAACP and all these other civil rights and major law firms Marty, think that we're wearing, they know we're not wearing aluminum hats.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
It's very real.
But numbers don't lie.
And I would hope this person would educate and have an open mind.
Well, there you go.
These patients need help.
Yeah. And if a clinic can, if I could bill out 48 invoices for $128,000 a month, I'd be a pretty rich man just in one building, one invoice, one company. These
yes.
guys are 50 miles apart all over the place in the country.
And you can't get out of, you can't have a choice of where to go. You complain, you cause any problem by untrained personnel. You have no right to complain. And if you do and don't shut up, you're going to pay a price. And I keep telling patients, they will get in your face and absolutely try to make you angry to get rid of you. It's called Weed
yes.
and Feed. And these companies, from what we're understanding, these companies are get rid of the patients that are costing us money. We don't care how you do it.
Yes.
This isn't healthcare.
Right.
Is the infiltrations that they caused on my wife's arm, and they kept telling me, you know, it's all part of it. It's all part of it. A year and a half, she had 17 times that they went through her arm and infiltrated her arm with the needle.
So my vascular surgeon sent them a note and told them that they needed to use the same tech every time that they were running my fistula. And they tried to accommodate for like 2 days, and then they didn't do that.
Why
after.
Are you guys doing this? You're making this a lot harder than it is.
Yeah.
Oh,
you
no. It's not about you. It's not about health care. And the thing is, as a worker, I worked for a hospital unit where you got to know your patients. You loved your patients. You knew about their children. You knew about their grandchildren. Mm-hmm. But what really is bothering me, guys, is that it's happening to a much younger age group now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My wife missed my son's graduation year, his senior year, because we had to go to dialysis. And anybody that's been around patients that have been or is on dialysis, there's not much of a life after that. When you go to your treatment,
mm-hmm.
you just try to survive for your next treatment. There's not much of a life
well,
in between having, treatment.
I was going to ask Carrie also, and you too. Is I've heard a lot of patients say, and it's really, really pathetic, is that you're feeling good the day after maybe, but then you start worrying about who's going to stick you and who's going to take care of you and who, you really don't get any peace.
I couldn't get any sleep. I mean, I started having a panic attack. My heart started racing the closer we got to the dialysis clinic. You know, and trying to calm down, and they wouldn't let me take anything for blood pressure or while I was on dialysis or anything like that. So by the time I got there, I was almost in full panic the last month I was there, trying to keep my composure the entire time.
Oh, they completely harassed. I mean, they made her sign discontinued treatments to use the restroom. They made her sign refusal of treatments to go to the restroom when she was sick. If she was more than welcome to use a bedpan in a room full of 10 other guys.
They're all guys in the room. They moved me down, my chair down to the by the isolation chamber when my antibodies were the lowest.
And not in a year and a half had they ever did any of this until after we asked them questions and asked them to please find out what's going on with this.
With the fraud thing. As soon as I brought the fraud thing up, it was like systematic retaliation, like they had a protocol.
You know,
I sat in the chair while the nurse, the head nurse called all the techs to the desk. I was by the nurse's station. I was probably 15 feet away from it. And they all started mm-hmm. whispering like they were putting together a plan on what to do with me after that. You know,
did they turn the machine away from you, Carrie?
Yeah.
So you
they
couldn't
kept
see it and started playing with it.
Well, I started keeping up with the numbers because, like I said, I got a copy of my records, and then they started giving me copies. Well, I started looking, and my rates of flow during treatment, they were changing while I was sleeping. Like, I was supposed to be at 300 milliliters per second, and they would change it up to 400 and 450. But I was noticing on my treatment sheets that while I was sleeping, because they make notes on their patients sleeping, and they would change my flow rates up. And I questioned that. Well, why would they put me at 450 flow rate with a 17-gauge needle? Well,
That's illegal. That's called speed dialysis.
Right. Yeah. So they started doing stuff like that. So I started staying awake during dialysis. And then I started noticing the machine, that when they give me the treatment sheet, the machine wouldn't match what it was on the treatment sheet. Then I realized the machine didn't talk to their computer. They were entering it into the computer. So they could put in anything in that computer regardless of what the machine was saying. So I started taking notes on the numbers on the machine in every single screen, and I had them – every time they come up to it, I had them turn the machine towards me so I could watch the numbers, the flow. Like they would turn down my temperature to 35 Celsius, you know, which is like 95 degrees. I mean, and I'd be freezing to death. And then stuff like that. And I started catching things like that. Like, wait a second, that's supposed to be on 36.3, you know. Certain things like that, catching things on the machine that they were changing the numbers on the machine, what it was normally, and then talking to what it used to be, you know, looking at my papers of what it was when it was right, until after I complained about them, you know, my signature and everything. And then they started changing the setup on the machine, you know, how high the alarm should go off when my blood pressure reached a certain level. It used to be set at like 180 as a high one, and I think it was 100 as the low one. Well, they set it up like 200 over 150, so my machine wouldn't even go off if my blood pressure went up high or low. The machine wouldn't go off to let them alert them that I was either crashing or that I was fixing to have
more of an inconvenience when the bells and whistles on the machine were going off.
So
a lot of times you just go and hit it and don't find out the cause either.
Yeah, we've only got about 3 minutes left here. I want to thank everyone for coming on this evening. William and Carrie, thank you so much. This has been
an
education. And Tom, I want to remind everybody
about Tom.
Yeah, well, his book, Crisis of Conscience, Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud, is available at Barnes & Noble. It's available on Amazon. It's also available on Kindle and probably other major booksellers also. So if you can pick that up, please do. It's an eye-opener and an education for people who really don't understand what whistleblowing is. Tonight's show with William and Carrie is a whistleblowing on dialysis and the racket that's being run there, the people's lives being put in jeopardy, all for profits, every bit of it for profits. And I think, again, as I find in every one of these situations, what makes me most nauseous is the people willing to participate in doing these things to another human being. Where in the hell did all you sick souls come from? It's just hard to believe there's that many people that'll do these kind of things for a paycheck. In the meantime, I want to remind everyone these shows are brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit, taking place at the end of July every year in Washington, D.C. We will all be out there again this year, come hell or high water. And I hope you can make it out there, too. It's open to the public, and it's quite an education. Arlene, thank you for co-hosting this evening and bringing your dialysis patients on. And we will be back Sunday night with Tanya Talks. And hope
and
you all
Tom,
have a good evening. Go ahead.
I was going to say, William, you owe me that barbecue when I'm in Texas.
No problem, man.
You owe me a barbecue. Okay. Good night, and thank you, Marty.
Good night. Thanks, everyone.